So we're going to start chapter 9 today, the most confidential knowledge. And let's begin with text 1. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Idam Tute Guhyatamam Pravakshamyanasuyave Gyanam Vigyana Sahitam Yajgyatva Mokshase Shubhat. The Supreme Personality Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge. And knowledge and realization, knowing which you shall be relieved of the miseries of material existence." So in this particular section, Krishna is going to talk about hearing, right? Hearing about him. He's going to start describing himself, jnana vijnana, both knowledge and realized knowledge. And so the qualification to hear about Krishna is an important part of this section. Prabhupada says here in the purport, as a devotee hears more and more about the Supreme Lord, he becomes enlightened. This hearing process is recommended in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Quote, "The messages of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are full of potencies, and these potencies can be realized if topics regarding the Supreme Godhead are discussed amongst devotees. This cannot be achieved by the association of mental speculators or academic scholars, for it is realized knowledge." So, notice Prabhupada here, immediately he begins to define vijnan, as Krishna said here, jnana vijnanam sahitam. So Krishna is going to explain knowledge and realize knowledge. So there's a big difference, right? And Prabhupada's pointing to it here, using the Bhagavatam, explaining that essentially you have to hear amongst devotees, right? Especially among experienced, realized, learned devotees, individuals that actually apply Krishna consciousness and practice it, right? Because there's a difference between just knowledge and realized knowledge. So, you know, if you hear from someone who just has knowledge, they've just some scholar who studied Bhagavad Gita, but never really practiced it, doesn't really believe it, doesn't worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, doesn't follow the directions of the Bhagavad Gita, it's practically going to be meaningless. As we mentioned before, how many times have you, you know, heard of the Bhagavad Gita before, perhaps before you're a devotee, and you just read some scholarly presentation of Bhagavad Gita, and nothing really happened. In fact, it even made it more difficult to understand, right? Like sometimes the way they present it, they deliberately obfuscate it, you know, with poetic language. They try to make it more mysterious, you know. Wow, this ancient text cannot be understood. Look how cryptic it is, you know, and they get some sort of taste from that, you know, as they're looking into something dark and mysterious. But Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita shines like the light, right? It shines out because Prabhupada himself is practicing the message of the Bhagavad Gita 100%. And so this is the difference. If you hear vijnana, or you hear that knowledge from realized persons, then it has the power to affect your heart. Okay? Let's look at the second paragraph here. It says, "The devotees are constantly engaged in the Supreme Lord's service. The Lord understands the mentality and sincerity of a particular living entity who is engaged in Krishna consciousness and gives him the intelligence to understand the science of Krishna and the association of devotees. Discussion of Krishna is very potent, and if a fortunate person has such association and tries to assimilate the knowledge, then he will surely make advancement towards spiritual realization. Lord Krishna, in order to encourage Arjuna to higher and higher elevation, and his potent service describes in this 9th chapter matters more confidential than he has already disclosed." Okay? So as Krishna is saying here, he's going to enter into confidential knowledge, guhyatamam. He's going to describe that which is most secret, guhya. Guhya means secret. So Krishna is actually going to reveal to us knowledge which generally isn't given out to human beings, right? In fact, throughout the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada mentions this concept of confidential, more confidential, and most confidential. So, the confidential knowledge is knowledge of the impersonal Brahman, right? More confidential is knowledge of the Paramatma, and most confidential is knowledge of the Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. And the practice of actually entering into a relationship with Bhagavan, or interacting with them, especially through the 5 rasas, this is considered most confidential knowledge, right? This is a very high level of subject matter. So that's what Krishna is going to talk about here in this particular chapter. Okay? And Prabhupada mentions here, let's take a look at, let's skip ahead one paragraph. Now this first verse has specific significance. The words idam jnanam, this knowledge, refers to pure devotional service which consists of 9 different activities: hearing, chanting, remembering, serving, worshiping, praying, obeying, maintaining friendship, and surrendering everything. By the practice of these 9 elements of devotional service, one is elevated to spiritual consciousness, Krishna consciousness. When one's heart is thus cleared of material contamination, one can understand this science of Krishna. Simply to understand that a living entity is not material is not sufficient. That may be the beginning of spiritual realization, but one should recognize the difference between activities of the body and spiritual activities of one who understands that he is not the body. Okay? So Prabhupada again is distinguishing between, you know, confidential knowledge and the most confidential knowledge. So confidential knowledge, again, is knowledge of Brahman, and you can kind of classify knowledge that you're not the body on that level. Okay? And Krishna, in the 2nd chapter, he's already talked about that in detail, that we're not this material body. This is the very beginning of spiritual life, is really to understand this practically, right? To develop some realization of this. And to really act beyond that platform then means to act in devotional service. Because it's one thing to actually just know that you're not the body, but to actually act on the platform of not being the body, that means to worship Krishna, right? You're going to put that knowledge into action, because the spirit soul, who is not the body, is also an eternal servant of Krishna. And so therefore, when Krishna says idam jnanam, he's referring to the knowledge of the soul's activities on the spiritual platform, the knowledge of the soul who understands that he's not the body, right? So that's idam jnanam. And let's take a look at the last paragraph here. The Sanskrit word anasuyave in this verse is also very significant. Generally, the commentators, even if they are highly scholarly, are all envious of Krishna, the Supreme Person of the Godhead. Even the most erudite scholars write on Bhagavad Gita very inaccurately. Because they are envious of Krishna, their commentaries are useless. The commentaries given by devotees of the Lord are bona fide. No one can explain Bhagavad Gita or give perfect knowledge of Krishna if he is envious. One who criticizes the character of Krishna without knowing him is a fool. Such commentaries should be very carefully avoided. For one who understands that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the pure and transcendental personality, these chapters will be very beneficial. Okay? So in order to properly understand these chapters, especially where Krishna is talking about the most confidential knowledge, you really do have to be a devotee. You have to be approaching Krishna, you know, with the full understanding of his position as the Supreme Lord, yours as the servant, and you have to be engaging on that platform, right? For example, when you study the Shastras, you're not supposed to just study, you know, you're supposed to actually do service. You're supposed to engage in some sort of work for Krishna. Like you have to, one aspect of studying is to memorize things, memorize shlokas, stuff like that. Another aspect is to actually contemplate it and think about it, right? And really, you know, make the philosophy part of your life. Right? Use the philosophy as like a guideline for how you're going to do things. You know, like you internalize it, you think of the world through the philosophy, and you look at your life through the philosophy, right? The decisions you make in the light of the philosophy. It becomes part of you. That's another aspect of learning. And then the final aspect of learning is to put it into practice, right? You have to actually act according to the philosophy. And so that's basically what's being mentioned here, is that in order to understand this, you really have to be doing that. You have to be acting according to the philosophy to really understand it. And that can only be done by those who are anasuyave, who are non-envious. Okay? So there's kind of like a threshold, like, you know, sort of like a fence. You know, how low can you go? What is that? Limbo, right? Jack be nimble, Jack be quick, you know, whatever, and they're dancing and they're trying to go under it, and they have to kind of go lower and lower and lower, right? So there's like a bar that you have to be able to go under before you can actually understand Bhagavad Gita. And what that bar is, it's whether or not you're envious, right? Whether or not you actually have the right attitude towards the personality of Godhead. Whether your attitude towards Krishna is one of humility and service and reverence and acceptance, right? And you genuinely, in a sense, you love Krishna, you love God, that you want to, you just want God to be happy, and you want him to be satisfied, you want him to be glorified, you don't want anything for yourself, and you don't have any negative attitude towards God, right? There's a kind of purity of heart in your relationship with God, purity of purpose in your relationship that has to be there. Otherwise, if you've got some kind of strange antagonism going on, then it's not going to work. because you're not going to be able to engage in his service properly. You're not going to develop the kind of like prerequisite lifestyle that's needed to accompany your study. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it's just like, for example, you know, like if if you've been around to say a temple for a long period of time, you could see there's all sorts of people that come and attempt to practice Krishna consciousness. And some people are very successful because they have like a right attitude immediately, right? Like some people have a very humble attitude towards Krishna. They want to do service to Krishna. They're enthusiastic to learn about Krishna. And then there's others who are basically like fighting against it the whole way, you know, like they really are antagonistic towards Krishna, ultimately antagonistic to the devotees, you know, always looking for some fault, criticizing, you know, angry, upset and disturbed. So you don't really go very far with that attitude. Right? So like much of approaching the personality of Godhead, much of understanding his own discussions of himself in the Shastra is really you having the right qualification, having the right like attitude and personality. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So the anasuyave is essential, as Krishna says in this particular verse, that pravavakshyam yanasuyave. So the, you know, I'm imparting this to you, right? Because you're essentially envious of me. You're anasuyave. Like you have the right attitude to understand me. Remember, Krishna's covered by a yoga maya samavrata. He's covered by a curtain. Yeah? And you can't see him. You can't penetrate that curtain. You can't understand him. You can't have a relationship with him unless you move through that curtain. It's just like here in Los Angeles, you know, we're surrounded by wealthy, famous celebrities, but you never meet them, you know, rarely, unless they come into Govindas or something, right? Or you have some kind of program or something where you go there and they happen to be there or something. But for the most part, they, even though we're surrounded by each other, I'm sure you've probably driven by hundreds of celebrities, because we have these movie studios just right here within literally a 5-minute walk. So, you know, you've probably driven by them, been sitting next to them and stuff like that. And that's where they film all their shows and music videos and all that stuff. It's all filmed on these sound stages. So you're surrounded by them, but they're in an entirely another like class of society, and you don't have access to them, right?
Right.
you'll never get close. So unless, of course, you have the right attitude and you approach in the right way, you know what I mean? Like you're essentially non-envious. I mean, that's why a lot of celebrities, they don't want to hang out with normal people, as normal people can't be normal with them, right? They hang out with other celebrities because other celebrities can be normal with them. They can have the right attitude. They're not like stalkerish or anything like that. You know what I mean? They've got like a comfortable, relaxed attitude. Whereas with your average person on the street, they can't really have that relationship, right? Because their attitude isn't correctly. So it's the same thing with the personality of Godhead, ultimately. Like in order to hang out with God, who's the greatest celebrity, you really have to be allowed into that association, right? You have to be welcomed in. You have to be a friend. You have to be somebody who is trusted. And that comes from your attitude. And basically as devotees, we spend our lives proving our attitude. We spend our lives, you know, developing it, developing the right attitude, developing the right culture, the right behavior with others, especially other devotees. And we're developing the right behavior and attitude with Krishna by rendering service and cultivating our bhakti, right? We're basically qualifying ourselves to meet the personality of Godhead and hang out with him. And so there is definitely this curtain that you cannot pass unless Krishna feels like you're qualified. Okay? So that's kind of what this verse is talking about. And in this particular chapter, Krishna is offering people entrance past that curtain. He's essentially saying, okay, I'm going to open the curtain now, and I'm going to allow you in, you know, Arjuna, because you're anasuyave. And of course, the rest of us, we get the benefit of this. We can hear about what Krishna is discussing. Okay? Let's take a look at text 2. Rajavidjirajaguhyam pavitramidum uttamam pratyakshavagamam dharmyam susukam kartamavyayam. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed. So this is one of the Bhakti Shastri verses. So it's Raja Vidya, the king of education, Raja Guhyam. It's the king of secrets, right? So again, Krishna is hidden. Pavitram idam uttamam. And it's the purest form of knowledge, right? Pratyaksha vagamam dharmyam. So this is very important. It gives direct realization of the self, direct perception. So there's different ways in which through Vedic literature that one can receive knowledge, right? There's through shruti, or through hearing, yeah? There's through pratyaksha, which is direct perception, and there's through anumana, which is inference. So these are different ways in which it's considered within our Vaishnava tradition. Other traditions have more, right? Like, for example, in Nyaya, they have the different prasthans, you know, the different ways in which one can understand reality or accepted means by which one can gather knowledge. And within the Vaishnava tradition, though, you have three. Okay, you have the Shruti, you have the Shastra, and then which is considered the highest authority. Then you have the anumana or logical inference, such as like in mathematics, you know, like if you see in a laboratory, a scientist has this very huge, you know, equation on a chalkboard or something. Basically, that's anuman. You know, you're using logic and reason to try to develop a authoritative position on what is reality. Okay. And then there is pratyaksha, which is direct perception. You see something right in front of your senses, right? The sky is blue. Why? Because you're looking right at it, right? So this Raja Vidya, this king of all knowledge, it gives direct perception of the self through pratyaksha. Like you'll directly experience with your own senses spiritual truth, right? People say, show me God. Well, that's what it's saying here. Yes, you know, by this process, you'll see God. You'll directly experience, okay? You'll see God with your eyes, you know, with your nose, with your tongue, with your ears. You know, you'll have direct realization right there in front of you. Pratyaksha literally means like right in front of your eyes, right? So direct perception of the self, susukam kartam avyam, so it's joyfully performed. And Prabhupada will talk about this in the purport, that this Raja Vidya, Krishna consciousness, is something that's joyful. You know, basically eating, you know, prasadam, dancing in kirtan, etc. It's a very easy process because it's joyful. Because it's something pleasurable, okay? And of course, it's avyam, it's everlasting, it's transcendental. Prabhupada says here, this chapter of Bhagavad Gita is called the King of Education because it is the essence of all doctrines and philosophies explained before. Among the principal philosophers in India are Gautama, Kanada, Kapila, Yajnavalkya, Sandilya, and Vaishnavanara. And finally, there is Vyasadeva, the author of the Vedanta Sutra. So there is no dearth of knowledge in the field of philosophy or transcendental knowledge. Now the Lord says that this ninth chapter is the king of all such knowledge, the essence of all knowledge that can be derived from the study of the Vedas and different kinds of philosophy. It is most confidential because confidential or transcendental knowledge involves understanding the difference between the soul and the body. And the king of all confidential knowledge culminates in devotional service. Okay? All right.
Pastor, mm-hmm. Anumana inferred, correct?
So yeah.
There's Sabda Brahma, which is knowledge received from Parampara. And then there's Pratyaksha, which is directly experienced, and then anumana is inferred.
Yes.
Okay.
So then you have, as Prabhupada's saying here, essentially when Krishna says it's the Raja Vidya, he's really referring, this is Vedanta Sutra. Like this is Vedanta. This is within the field of there's Saddarshan, there's six systems of philosophy that are considered bona fide within the Vedic culture, right? There's Nyaya, there's Karma Mimamsa, there's Patanjali's Yoga, right? So there's these different six systems of philosophy, Vaisheshika, and then there's this one, which is Vedanta, which is the one that we're in. Okay, we're considered in the Vedanta school of philosophy. And the Vedanta Sutra by Srila Vyasadeva is our primary, you might say, source of knowledge. And so the Vedanta school is based on the Vedanta Sutra. And then there's two different broad categories within the Vedanta school. There's the Mayavad class, and then there's the Vaishnavas, right? And the Mayavadis have their interpretation of Vedanta Sutra, the Sharirika Bhasha by Shankaracharya. And then the Vaishnavas have their interpretations of the Vedanta Sutra as well, like the Sri Bhasha and the Govinda Bhasha. And of course, as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, primarily we accept this book here, the Srimad Bhagavatam, to be the commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. Okay? And so really, our whole philosophy comes from the Srimad Bhagavatam. And, you know, Bhagavad Gita also as well. But primarily, the Srimad Bhagavatam is our main text. It is our commentary on Vedanta Sutra, and we are considered Vedantists. All right? So when Krishna is speaking of the Raja Vidya, he's speaking of the Vedanta, which means the end of all knowledge. It's the highest level of knowledge that can be there. Okay? All right. So let's take a look, jumping ahead one sentence. The Bhagavad Gita, especially from the second chapter on, stresses the importance of the soul. In the very beginning, the Lord says that this body is perishable and that the soul is not perishable. Antavanti ime deha nitya syukta sharirinaha. That is a confidential part of knowledge. Simply knowing that the spirit soul is different from this body and that its nature is immutable, indestructible, and eternal. But that gives no positive information about the soul. Sometimes people are under the impression that the soul is different from the body, and that when the body is finished or one is liberated from the body, the soul remains in a void and becomes impersonal. But actually, that is not the fact. How can the soul, which is so active within this body, be inactive after being liberated from the body? It is always active. It is eternal. Then it is eternally active. If it is eternal, then it is eternally active, and its activities in the spiritual kingdom are the most confidential part of spiritual knowledge. These activities of the spirit soul are therefore indicated here as constituting the king of all knowledge, the most confidential part of all knowledge. So Prabhupada reiterating again that the highest level of knowledge is action on the platform of the soul, meaning devotional service. Okay, and these other systems of philosophy, such as Nyaya, Nyaya, it doesn't really talk about the nature of the soul in devotional service, right? Like Nyaya is using Anuman, it's the emphasis is on inference and using logic and reason. It's basically trying to construct a valid, reasonable perspective of reality and move towards the absolute truth through that process. And it has to do with cultivating tools. Like, for example, in Western culture, you'll find, you know, a list of logical fallacies, and there's ancient Greek philosophers studied this heavily, you know, how to have an actual, you know, how to use logic and reason. In fact, it's one of the foundational principles of Western civilization, especially post-Enlightenment, is looking at the world scientifically, using just pure reason, empirical knowledge gathering, right? You might say categorizing the various things in reality, trying to penetrate them and understand them, both through the senses, but also through pure logic and reason. And there's the rejection of Shruti, the rejection of faith, the rejection of Shastric authority. And so you'll find within the Vedic culture, these same things are kind of there, these six systems, which will emphasize, you know, they may de-emphasize Shruti or they may emphasize Anuman. For example, in Nyaya, in the system of philosophy, you know, like Sarvabhaum Bhattacharya, he was a teacher of Navanyaya. He was actually like an acharya of that system of philosophy. So he was, before he became a devotee, he was a practitioner of Nyaya. And so it's very much just about avoiding logical fallacies and developing a very clear logical perspective on life and self-realization, you see. And then you have, you know, Vaisheshika and Sankhya, which are basically also, they will ultimately come to knowledge of the personality of Godhead. Like, for example, with Sankhya, you know, ultimately there's an understanding of the supersoul that's there. This is in the theistic Sankhya school. But it's not so developed, right? It'll categorize reality much like modern science, you know, has all the different categories for animals and basically deconstructing reality into finer and finer particles. So that's kind of like the way in which Sankhya approaches reality through categorization. And ultimately there's knowledge of the supersoul is there as well. And then within the Vaisheshika school, it's like, you know, it's very much about sort of studying a kind of atomic theory. I guess dividing up the universe basically into atoms and sort of looking at the development of the universe from the atomic level. It's almost like an ancient Vedic perspective on science, right? And ultimately there, you know, they may come to some level that you're not the body and maybe even that there's a supreme soul there. And in Patanjali's yoga also, there's an understanding of the supersoul. But again, it's not like the central thing. It's not like you engage in worship or service of the Supersoul, right? There may be meditation on the Supersoul ultimately. And even within, you know, the first principles of the of Patanjali's yoga system, you know, there's Ishvara Pranidhana, like one must actually offer reverence and obeisances to the personality of Godhead just to practice that particular system of yoga. But it's not, you know, in the ultimate conclusion, you're not going to find such an emphasis on unalloyed devotion to the personality of Godhead, right? So you have these different systems, you know, but ultimately the position of the personality of Godhead is not quite as central. Whereas once you get Vedanta, and especially the Vaishnava school of Vedanta Sutra, then in that particular darshan, then the personality of Godhead is at the very center, right? And his worship is at the center, and the position of the soul as the servant of the personality of Godhead is really the essence of everything, right? And learning how to develop that particular quality, especially by associating through hearing. Hearing the glories of the Lord, you know, he descends in his incarnations, essentially in order to give us something to hear about, how to associate with him with our ears. So through the Vedanta Darshan, you're really going to just associate with the personality of Godhead and associate with his devotees and render transcendental service and immerse yourself in the name of the personality of Godhead, right? And essentially, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, man mana bhavamad bhakta madhyaji mam namaskaru, right? You're going to put your mind on the personality of Godhead. You're going to offer obeisances to the personality of Godhead. Yeah? You're going to worship the personality of Godhead. So you're going to become his devotee. So this is that message that Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita, which is really that, you know, it's the end of this chapter. It's the essential message of the Gita itself, the very central verse of the Bhagavad Gita, actually. The end is 18th chapters. This verse is at the in the very middle, at the end of the 9th chapter. So the you might say like the final expression of this Rajavidya, or most confidential knowledge, is pure devotional service to Krishna and worship to Krishna. And that's, as Prabhupada's pointing out here, that's part of the Vedanta school. The Vedanta school makes that position, that man mana bhavamad bhakta, is the core teaching of the Vedanta school. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. No? Okay. As long as it doesn't, we can move on. All right. Let's see here. So let's take a look at the second or the next paragraph. This knowledge is the purest form of all activities, as explained in the Vedic literature. In the Padma Purana, man's sinful activities have been analyzed and are shown to be the result of sin after sin. Those who are engaged in fruitive activities are entangled in the different stages and forms of sinful reactions. For instance, when the seed of a particular tree is sown, the tree does not appear immediately to grow. It takes some time. It is first a small sprouting plant, then it assumes the form of a tree. Then it flowers and bears fruit. And when it is complete, the flowers and fruits are enjoyed by persons who have sown the seed of the tree. Similarly, a man performs a sinful act, and like a seed, it takes time to fructify. There are different stages. Excuse me. The sinful actions may have already stopped within the individual, but the results or the fruit of that sinful action are still to be enjoyed. There are sins which are still in the form of a seed, and there are others which are already fructified and are giving us fruit, which we are enjoying as distress and pain. Okay, and then Prabhupada quotes this verse a little bit down. Aparabdha palam papam kutam bijam palonmukam kramanaiva pladiyeta vishnu bhakti datatmanam. Right, I'll just read the translation. For those who are engaged in devotional service as Prem Sneha Godhead, all sinful reactions, whether fructified in the stalk or in the form of a seed, gradually vanish. Therefore, the purifying potency of devotional service is very strong and is called pavitram uttamam, the purest. So, Vishnu Bhakti Datatmanam. So, anyway, by worshipping the personality of Godhead, you're going to burn up the sinful desire seeds within the heart. Okay? And we heard about this in Nectar Devotion, or you will hear. And so these are the different stages of sin. And essentially what happens is the sin, you know, when you perform a sinful activity, let's just go right to the chase, when you have illicit sex, right? When illicit sex is there, a little picture you have within you, I like to give the example like a pot the size of this room. Okay? I don't know what, 40 by 40 or something. So then when you have a pot the size of this room and a mustard seed is then put into this pot, right? And your pot is filled with mustard seeds already. And they go all the way to the ceiling. Yeah, and one more, boink, you know, mustard seed goes right in there, and it goes right at the bottom of the pile. And when it goes to the bottom of the pile, another one is pushed up right against the ceiling, and it gets sucked up right through the ceiling. And you look on top of the ceiling, it's like a it's like a field, right? And that seed starts to fructify, and then it turns into, you know, a plant, right? And eventually it bears fruit. And that fruit is really twofold, or rather, two things are happening simultaneously. As that seed, as it turns into a plant, then not only is it going to bear fruit, but it's also going to bear, you know, further seeds, right? Like if you perform a sinful activity, again, you know, in other words, you have, when you perform a sinful action, then when that fructifies, you know, you suffer, right? It's in the form of suffering, but also you have a sinful nature. Like two things are really going on simultaneously. Because you perform that sinful activity, and underneath you is this giant stalk of mustard seeds, right, of sinful desire seeds, you have a sinful nature. It's like your consciousness is sinful, and therefore you're filled with lust. Therefore, when you walk down the street or whatever, one is filled with the desire for illicit sex constantly because of all the sinful desire seeds within your heart. Because your subconscious mind, you might say, or your samskaras, are totally compacted and filled with these sinful activities from the past. You see? So you have a sinful proclivity, a sinful nature. And then simultaneously, as the fruits are coming out, you're also experiencing sinful reactions in the form of suffering. Okay? So you not only do you experience suffering, but you have a sinful nature so that you desire to continue doing it. That's very heavy, right? You're suffering, but you can't stop doing it because you're so filled with these desire seeds. It's like if you look at a drug addict, you know, you can see that a drug addict, especially like something like meth or something like that, you know, literally they're like picking scabs off their face, you know, like scratching their face on this, and their face is covered in scabs and they're picking them off and they look like a zombie, right? Their eyes are all sucked into the back of their head. And they're horrible. I mean, you can see pictures where just a couple of years before, you know, they're a beautiful woman or something, and then just 2 years later, you can't even recognize them. They look like, you know, a troll that lives under a bridge or something, right? Like their hair, they look like they're about, you know, they're in their 20s, but they look about 60 or 70, right? And you can only imagine what kind of horrible experiences they've been through, what kind of a nightmare they've lived through. But why can't you stop? Well, because it's a sinful action. Right? You're filled with the sinful desire to do it again, and yet the very action itself is causing a tremendous amount of suffering. It's actually destroying you. So this is a very dangerous thing, and the soul gets sucked into this cycle. And it's like a whirlpool, right? Like it spins you around and sucks you down at the same time. You're under the control of the whirlpool, right? As soon as you step in, the current is pulling you against your will. So similarly, sinful activities, as soon as you put them inside you, as soon as you put that seed in there, then immediately you're filled with the desire to do it again. And it's pushing you like that current. And it's sucking you down into suffering. That's why Arjuna is so scared. Guru nahatva himhanubhavan, shreyam bhoksham bhaipksham apiha loke. It's better to beg in this world than commit, you know, sins of killing our guru, right? For worldly happiness. So he's terrified, actually, of performing sins because he knows this is what happens to you. Therefore, somebody who understands the cycle of sin in the heart is always careful to keep themselves from sinning. And how do you keep yourself from sinning? You try to keep yourself engaged in properly, right? You keep yourself engaged in devotional service. And so when Krishna says here, pavitram idam uttamam, this is the, you know, this process is supremely purifying, right? Raja vidya raja guhyam pavitram idam uttamam. So this process, not only is it the king of all knowledge, not only is it Vedanta, right? Not only is the worship and surrender to the personality of God at the highest level of knowledge, but it's completely purifying. Shrinvatam svakata Krishna punya shravana kirtana, right? Huridantasto yabhadrani. So all the abhadranis, all these sinful desires, all the anarthas in the heart, they become purified by hearing about Krishna, by worshipping Krishna, by associating with Krishna. So it's very fascinating because, you know, we're mentioning you have these sadarshan, right? You know, Sankhya, Nyaya, Yoga, Karma Mimamsa, Vedanta, and then Vaisheshika, right? So these different darshans, and Karma Mimamsa we didn't mention, but it's basically like materialistic performance of sacrifice. It's kind of like if a materialist Just like we have, say, a modern, mundane person who just works all day and tries to enjoy their senses with no higher goal in life, or to somehow or other understand the science of Vedic sacrifices and is trying to satisfy themselves through basically the performance of, you know, ritual. I might say magic, right? The performance of worship of demigods in particular, and trying to go to the heavenly planets and trying to enjoy benedictions from the demigods in the form of enjoyment of this world. Okay? So it's basically like a pious materialist who's a technocrat, like he's really capable at manipulating nature by using yajnas. And so, and that's what you'll see Krishna in the, you know, in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the 10th canto when he's arguing against, you know, worshipping Indra. So he's using actually arguments from Karma Mimamsa. So anyway, and that's not, you know, the Karma Mimamsa is not really concerned about transcendence at all. It's more like a philosophy of material enjoyment, right? Basically, the whole world is the highest principle in the world is karma, and you know the highest goal, therefore, is to somehow utilize your knowledge of the science of karma, manipulate the laws of karma, to try to keep yourself in a good position within the world. Be pious, do these yajnas, and you'll always be as happy as you can be. But you see, with Vedanta in particular, it's very different than these other systems in that it's just Krishna kind of stepping into the room and saying, hello, everybody. You know, I'm the personality of Godhead. Come hang out with me, right? Come associate with me. You know, come over here, you know, touch my hand, right? It's very personal. It's not some sort of philosophical system, you know, just sort of by your own power striving towards the absolute truth, either through intellect or through mechanical yoga practices. No, it's like it's Krishna himself setting up his embassy. You know, like Krishna has, you know, like you go to Mumbai or something and there's the American embassy, you know, it's got a flag, American flag, right? So, you know, the Vedanta school, the Bhagavat school is basically just Krishna coming into the world with all of his associates, right? And setting up his embassy, you know? Setting up his temples, you know, his devotees traveling out and trying to get people, come on, come be here, you know, come have contact with Krishna. Like he puts himself out there, he puts himself into the world and essentially says, come, associate with me, hear about me, right? I'll uplift you and purify you by contacting me. Does that make sense? So that's what this pavitram is. It's the, you know, the whole cycle of sin in the heart is completely destroyed by essentially taking Krishna's hand, which he's offering out to us in the form of the Guru Parampara, in the form of service and everything like that. And then even though we may be sinful, right? Jnana plavanaiva, right? Even though you may be the most sinful of all sinners, still, by the boat of transcendental knowledge, you can cross over the ocean of material existence. Yeah? Krishna mentions there. Api said, what is it? Api chet asi pape bhyo sarve bho papakritamaha. So you're looking at papakritamaha right here, right? Even if you're an extremely sinful person, you're papakritamaha. Like of all the sinners, we're talking like Jagai and Madai, you know, people that murder, people that rape, people that rob, all these different horrible things. That's like papakritamaha. You know, you're on the FBI's most wanted list, right? You're on the Yamaduta's most wanted list. And so, you know, even though you're on that list, still, if you surrender to Krishna, then you can cross over the ocean of material existence in the palm of his hand, right? So that's what Krishna is doing. It's more or less his compassion. His personal compassion. It's not, it's like you look at Vedanta Darshan, it's not even, you know, at its core, it's not some philosophical construct, it's Krishna himself, right? And the Srimad Bhagavatam is the book incarnation of Krishna. So that's basically what it is. And so, therefore, he's giving himself. In this chapter, that's what he's talking about. I'm giving myself, essentially. And the only qualification, you have to be anasuyave. You see, if you want to practice these other systems, you know, there may be various qualifications, yeah? If you want to practice Sankhya or something, you have to be, you know, extremely intelligent or, you know, different things. You have, there are certain requirements. But with Krishna, you know, these are the type of requirements he gives. You have to be anasuyave. You can't be envious of me, right? You have to have this attitude of love, basically. You have to have the attitude of submission and surrender and friendship towards Krishna. Okay? All right. Anything else? Okay. So let's take a look here. Let's look at the skip ahead another paragraph. It says here, it is said that the execution of devotional service is so perfect that one can perceive the results directly. This direct result is actually perceived, and we have practical experience that any person who's chanting the holy names of Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, in course of chanting without offenses, feels some transcendental pleasure, and very quickly becomes purified of all material contamination. This is actually seen. Furthermore, if one engages not only in hearing, but in trying to broadcast the message of devotional activities as well, or if he engages himself in helping the missionary activities of Krishna consciousness, he gradually feels spiritual progress. So this is the Pratyaksha Bhagavam Dharmam. Right? You can directly perceive it. Like if you chant really good rounds, you can see your consciousness is totally changed. You can taste the holy name, right? You can experience, even if it's not very much, you know, just the slight luminosity of the holy name can make you feel bliss, or you can taste at least something is going on here, right? So that's true. You know, any devotee can tell you this, that you actually experience true spiritual realization or feeling while you're engaging in devotional service, okay? All right. Let's see here. So, of course, this is a very long purport. It's one of the longest in the Bhagavad Gita. But let's read another one. Jump ahead maybe two paragraphs. It says, the word dharmyam means path of religion. Narada was actually a son of a maidservant. He had no opportunity to go to school. He was simply assisting his mother. And fortunately, his mother rendered some service to the devotees. The child Narada also got the opportunity and simply by association achieved the highest goal of all religion. The highest goal of all religion is devotional service, as stated in Srimad Bhagavatam, Savai Pumsam Paro Dharmo Yato Bhakti Dadhoksaje. Religious people generally do not know that the highest perfection of religion is the attainment of devotional service. So there's a distinction between dharma and padadharma. Okay? So dharma just means religion, and here Prabhupada's translating paradharma as devotional service. And padadharma, you know, yato bhakti adhoksaje, is essentially bhakti to adhoksaja, or Krishna. Okay? So there's a difference between religion and bhakti. And so religion is more or less like a prerequisite for bhakti. I like to give the example of bhakti as the freeway, then religion is kind of the on-ramp. Right? It's basically like there's certain, in order to practice bhakti properly, you have to be religious. But bhakti is in a stage beyond religion. It's more, just like in modern sort of parlance, people make a distinction between religion and spirituality, right? There's kind of like, religion generally has the context of sort of like a belief system, like Christianity or something, a certain ideology that you adhere to. Whereas spirituality generally has generally people usually, when using that, they mean there's some practice there, right? You're doing something. It's a little bit more personal and engaging, and oftentimes, you know, less connected to a specific ideology, okay? So, there, you know, this is kind of a very old distinction. So you have religion is essentially to be a good person, right? To practice the various principles of dharma. And within the Vedic culture, you kind of have different classifications. Like on one level, you have varnashram dharma, right? Like how to actually behave in human society according to certain principles of your qualities that you cultivate and certain principles of action or vritti or how you work, right? How you conduct yourself in society and what kind of job you do, where you fit within and contribute to the social structure. So that's a very important part of your dharma. But then beyond that, there's also principles of being a good person, right? Sadachar, having proper behavior with others, you know. And basically, that's much of what you'll find in, you know, many religions, right? Like, do unto others as they'd have a do unto you, right? So much of it, like the golden rule, you know, try to be a nice person, love your neighbor, all that stuff. That's just kind of like a sub-level of dharma. But real dharma, or padadharma, transcendental dharma, it deals with the nature of the soul, which is an internal servant of Krishna. So your padadharma is beyond your material conditioning. It's you as an eternal servant of Krishna. Does that make sense? Okay? So you do have your material dharma. Right now you're in the body of a woman, right? But that's not you. You know, you're not Sukarupa, right? that's really, you know, when people think Sukarupa and the picture that comes in their mind, and that's not you, right? That's just the gross physical body. Now, there's a dharma that's associated with that body. There's a way to use that body that's in harmony with the laws of God. But there's also, behind all that, there's the real you, the soul. And that soul also has a dharma. Okay? And that's called paradharma. And that's your relationship with Krishna. And that's what you're trying to uncover by doing service to Krishna. But in order to uncover it, you got to use the sukharupa portion good too, right? That also has to be in harmony with the laws of God. Otherwise, it's going to have some serious problems. So, like, for example, you know, the nature itself. Why do people think nature is peaceful, right? Why is it that you go out into the forest in order to be peaceful? Well, because nature has this element of peace to it, right? It's comfortable, it's relaxing, it makes you feel purified. You know, there's not this, it doesn't, it's calm, it's beautiful. But why? Because it's following dharma, right? Everything in nature operates according to the laws of God. It naturally does. You know, the trees behave as trees are supposed to behave. The squirrels behave as squirrels are supposed to behave, right? And therefore, when you go into nature, you feel peaceful because everything's in the mode of goodness. Now, the activities they're doing, such as, you know, predation and, you know, the food chain and all that stuff, jivaso, jiva, what is it? Jivo, jivasya, jivanam, you know, they're devouring each other. And that's there. But even that is according to the laws of God. And therefore, in general, there's the sattva gun, which predominates in nature. And that's why spiritual practitioners are advised to practice in nature. Because it's the entire environment is according to the laws of God. And therefore, it makes you feel peaceful. Now, human beings are quite different. We can choose whether or not to follow dharma. We can choose whether or not to follow the laws of God. But, and therefore, within your material conditioning, because it is material, you can either choose to utilize that material conditioning in a way, just like nature, which is in harmony with the laws of God, or you can choose not to. It's kind of like it doesn't happen automatically, it's presented to you as a choice, and you have to learn how to actually harmonize yourself with the laws of God that govern your personal conditioning, right? You know, like an oak tree, it doesn't have to worry, right? It just grows as an oak tree is supposed to grow. So you're also an oak tree, like you're a certain kind of tree, you know, and you have a certain kind of conditioning, and there's a certain way that you're supposed to behave that's in harmony with the laws of God. But because you're a human being, and, you know, the principle of freedom of choice is so prominent, you have to learn that, and you have to deliberately choose that. But when you do, then you also become peaceful, just like nature, right? You also become happy and satisfied. And then that forms a good foundation from which to uncover the true nature of the soul. So it's important for the human being to essentially to align themselves with the laws of God so that they can actually bring forth, just like you bring forth fire from firewood, like we're talking about in Bhagavatam class, you can bring forth the nature of the soul. But, you know, in order to do that, the wood has to be dry, right? Like you when you're building a fire pit, whatever, there's a lot of things that go into that. You know, the wood has to be dry, there has to be kindling, right? So it's kind of like religion is kind of like when you're building that fire pit and you're following the laws of how to start a fire, your dad taught you and you go camping, right? And first you start with your your dry grasses, which burn easily. Then you put small sticks, then you put big sticks, and you got to make it like a pyramid, right? And that's the basic plan. So that's kind of like dharma. You know, you have to know exactly how to build the fire. You have to know the rules of what governs fires and what makes them light. And then you have to go through this process of cleaning out a pit and making it clean and making sure that everything's in order. And then you can actually light it. And so when the fire comes out of the wood, that's like the pure nature of the soul coming out of the material conditioning. Does that make sense? So in devotional service, we really do both at the same time. You know, like we don't come from dharmic backgrounds. We're like a bunch of wet wood, right? We don't come from backgrounds which very easily, except maybe Bhakti Ras, right? But we don't come from background, you know, she comes from a sattvic background. So we come from very, you know, unsattvic, let's be polite. We come from lower forms of conditioning where we have a tremendous amount of sinful nature in our conditioning, you see? And therefore we simultaneously have to learn how to be dharmic on the material platform and the spiritual platform simultaneously. And that's why you'll see, like, there's these traditions in India, for example, where, you know, because you have a Western body or something, you're not allowed in the Jagannath temple. Now, the reason they're saying that is essentially they're looking at you and saying, that body of yours, and you took that birth because of having a lot of sinful desire seeds within you. You see? And so you have a sinful nature. You know, they're basically looking at your physical body and saying, you have a sinful nature. That's why you took that birth. And they're correct. Right? But the problem is that they don't recognize, or rather what they don't understand, is the philosophical truth that Krishna consciousness is so powerful that it can burn away all those desire seeds. Right? That you can have a physical body which is born essentially from subdued to sinful desires. You took birth in a family of meat eaters, you took birth in a family of people who are intoxicated, and so many different things, illicit sex, all that stuff is there. Yet the power of Krishna, by his association, again, by taking his hand, it's so great that it can burn those desire seeds. And it can burn, you know, all the different reactions that are, you know, on their way up, right? So they don't see that, and therefore it's not a proper philosophical conclusion. You can't just look at the surface. You have to recognize the power of Krishna, this pavitram idam uttamam, that Krishna is supremely purifying. Okay? All right, any final questions about that? No? Okay, well, and this is such an important purport and verse, that's why we spent so much time on it today. Let's do like one or two more paragraphs. Let's look at this one paragraph jumping ahead. It says, the process of devotional service is a very happy one. Susukam, why? Devotional service consists of Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu. No one can simply hear the chanting of the glories of the Lord or attend philosophical lectures on transcendental knowledge given by authorized acharyas. Sorry, it says, one can simply hear the chanting of the glories of the Lord, or attend philosophical lectures on transcendental knowledge given by authorized acharyas. Simply by sitting, one can learn. Then one can eat the remnants of the food offered to God, nice palatable dishes, and every state of devotional service is joyful. One can execute devotional service even in the most poverty-stricken condition. So this is another meaning, right? There's susukam, means it's happy, it's joyful, right? Dancing and chanting, all that stuff. But it's also easy, meaning it doesn't cost a lot of money. Patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhakta prayachati, right? Krishna doesn't require gold ornaments. You know? If you go to worship other demigods, Lord Shiva or Durga or whatever, if you want to do a particular sacrifice, then you better get ready to pay, right? Especially, you know, in certain temples. Right? So if you go to some temple in India, you know, demigod temple, and you want to do a big elaborate sacrifice, they're going to really make sure you pay, right? And they're going to, you know, and if you want to do it according to the Shastra, which means the sure way to satisfy that particular god, then you've got to use very expensive ingredients. You know, you're talking, you know, $100,000. You know, like basically the cost of your house, you know, $300,000-$400,000, that's how much a yajna is going to cost, right? And that's just like a small one. You know, if you want to do like a horse sacrifice or one of these, you know, of course you have to, there's certain pre-qualifications like being the emperor of the world, which are not so easy to attain. But say somehow you do that, and that's cost, you know, even remember in the Mahabharata, Maharaj Yudhisthira, he couldn't even afford it, right? He had to send out his brothers, right, to collect Lakshmi. So it's an extremely expensive affair. Whereas Krishna, he just says, look, just give me a leaf. Doesn't even have to be a flower. You can just walk along, pick a leaf off there and go, hey, you know, and just offer it to Krishna. And he'll accept it just as if it was offered on a golden plate. You know, for him it makes no difference, right? And you can't really offer anything to Krishna because it already belongs to him. You know, but it's the devotion, bhakti pahitam. That's what he wants. So if you could take that piece of leaf or that little bit of water that you have, right? You know, just some water you scooped with your hand out of the river and you just offer it to Krishna with devotion, then Krishna accepts it. You know? That's why when you offer stuff, you always got to put some devotion into it. You know, yeah. You can't just say Namo Vishnu Padaya 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 Namo Padaya Krishna Padaya Krishna Namo Mahabadaya Krishna Padaya Krishna. Okay, can we eat yet? Right, it's you have to actually pray, and you know, Krishna, please, you know, Hare Krishna, and like really pray Krishna to take it, because it's the bhakti he wants. He doesn't care about, you know, your Pop Tart. Whatever it is you're offering, you know. Krishna doesn't care about your frozen pizza or something, you know. That's not, you know, he didn't descend to the world to eat frozen burritos, the slushies from 7-Eleven or whatever, right? He came to taste the birthday cake flavor of Slurpee, right? No. So it's the devotion that he wants, right? Okay. Prabhupada, I'll just finish this paragraph here. There are many instances in history simply by tasting the tulsi leaves offered to the lotus feet of the Lord. Great sages like Sanat Kumara became great devotees. Therefore, the devotional process is very nice and it can be executed in a happy mood. God accepts only the love with which things are offered to him. Okay. So thank you very much. All glories, Prabhupada.